This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
So juror number five that the Donna Adelson and crematorium defense team wants to bring up. Did you see that, Eric, by the way?
Did you see that?
Did you know that Tom Petty operates out of a crematorium? Not joking.
This case just keeps getting weirder, man.
Her office is at
a crematorium. Why am I not surprised?
It's the fair, like the young Fairfield crematory. And yep, there we go. Out of a house in a neighborhood.
Hey, you know what? You got to rent an office where you rent an office. I mean, it's all about availability. It reminds me of Johnny on Schitt's Creek operating out of the garage. You know, you do what you got to do, right?
Let me ask you this before we go on to the juror number five question. What's the strangest place you've ever seen an attorney operate out of as their office?
I've received indications of attorneys operating out of like coffee shops and places like that, which, yeah. You know, look, I get it. Remote practice is a big thing. That's cool, man.
But, I get that.
But you want to have some legitimacy behind what you're doing, and you want to project to the client that you are established.
Otherwise, it kind of feels like this almost feels worse than Better Call Saul. You know, it like he was operating out of the back of a nail salon. This is her. This is Tom Petty operating out of the back of a crematory. And it makes me what like. Is there like deals here? Are there sales? Can you, is that even legal as an attorney? Could you offer your client, let's say like you had part ownership here, because it appears maybe she does or some family member does. I don't know. Could you offer like, hey, you know, if you hire me as your attorney, we're going to give you half off your cremation or half off when someone passes, when Harvey passes, you can get him toasted here. It's like Subway. Would you like him toasted? And that offer can be made. You know, is that legal? Can you bundle services?
You know, it would vary by jurisdiction. In Colorado, where I practice, my recollection is that you can have sort of outside incentives so long as they don't compromise the integrity of the representation. They don't influence the representation. Yeah. But this one would be a rather macabre bundling of sex.
Yeah, I mean, thank God no attorney were operating out of the Return to Nature funeral home in your neighborhood.
Well, I was going to say, that's right in your neighborhood there, Eric.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, I've never been, but heard horror stories. Yeah.
Hey, weekend road trip, I'm telling you right there. You go over, pack a picnic in the parking lot. I think you and your lovely wife would have a great time. I think it'd be a lovely
lovely
weekend trip. Get on the list for Casa Bonita, and if you can't make it, go to the Return to Nature for lunch. Juror number five's podcast comments. This was said on Surviving the Survivor podcast, or friends over there, that they had noticed Adelson's facial expressions and reactions during the trial. Oh my, they noticed Donna reacting inappropriately, which the judge had to scold her for like five times. They claim that it wasn't a factor to them in the deliberations, but they certainly brought it up because everybody noticed it. Are we stretching here on the part of Tom Petty as Donna's attorney, as this being a valid argument? Is there any argument to be made that a juror after the fact said that, yeah, I witnessed Donna, you know, reacting very callously?
There could be something there, and shout out to Joel and Surviving the Survivor. I've been on it several times. Great podcast. Not as good as this one, but you know, the concern is that the jury can only base their verdict on the evidence, right? So on testimony, exhibits, things like that. You better believe they're looking at the defendant. They're seeing how the defendant's reacting. And Donna Adelson was not sheepish about her outbursts in the case.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think it's possibly what's called invited error. Even if it was error, it's something that Donna invited because she is the source of the subject matter we're talking about, which are her reactions.
Yeah, I mean, could that be part of, was that part of her strategy? I mean, there was a lot of weird things with her. I mean, the amount of attorneys they went through, the amount of times they had to push this trial. I mean, all these sort of things that could have been avoided, but seemingly were invited in by their own choices to delay this trial. I'm wondering if during the trial that was part of the strategy, was Donna going over the top?
You know, as a defense attorney, there's a fine line between elucidating error and inviting air. If there is air that already exists and you choose to kind of highlight that for the appellate record, that's probably zealous advocacy. On the other hand, if you or your client is injecting error into the case, you can't later, you know, whine to the appellate court that, hey, this was a problem at the trial. Well, the problem started with you, buddy.
Or can you? You could argue it.
You can,
but it doesn't mean it's going to go anywhere. Or will it? I guess, I mean, it's like spinning the dice. Stranger things happen. You know, it just makes me wonder. The other claim here, judicial bias allegations, the claims that Judge Everett gave prosecution extra time for technology while Full Ford, you know, got out the poster board that she got over at Hobby Lobby and put some clip art on it. They're saying that it denied Adelson more time to decide on testifying, tolerated gallery laughter and gestures, and showed obvious disdain towards defense. Thoughts on that?
The only one that jumps out as having potential merit is the disdain for defense. And unfortunately, that happens sometimes. I'm not saying it necessarily happened in this trial, but there are some judges, especially former prosecutors who are up there, who retain that mindset and sort of see things through their own prism of the prior prosecution experience, and sometimes are denigrating to defense. I don't think it rose to that level here, but that's what appellate courts look at, because the defense is entitled to an impartial jurist, an impartial judge who's not going to favor one side. I'm not sure that these grounds are really enough to get us over the appellate hump and get a new trial, but will all of these things together have a cumulative effect? Sometimes that happens.
Why do you think Donna chose an attorney operating out of a crematory?
Sorry.
Gosh. Yeah, it's tough out there sometimes. You know, resources can be an issue. Donna apparently was wealthy at one point. I don't know what her resources were like during the trial. But, you know, and there's also, you got to get an attorney who wants to do it. You know, she may have interviewed a bunch of attorneys and they were like, this case is a loser. I can't help you. So sometimes you're limited by those factors as well. And perhaps she just had a really good rapport with this attorney. You know, they bear a physical resemblance, and perhaps there was some warm and fuzzy feeling, and you know, that can be a deciding factor.
I kind of feel like that might have leaned that way a little bit with the similarities, just with what we know about Donna's narcissism and such. It did seem like they could have been two peas in a pod on that case there. It was stunningly scary how alike they seemed to be. But she lost. Do you keep the same attorney going forward on your appellate issues here if you're Donna Adelson?
At least in Colorado where I practice, almost never. I can't think of a time where I've seen trial counsel lose a case and then magically transform it to appellate counsel. It's a whole different type of practice. There are different standards of law. There's different case law of which you need to be aware. It's a whole different animal. And so to have the trial counsel doing the appeal is unusual. On the other hand, trial counsel has good insight and firsthand knowledge of everything that happened in the trial, whereas a detached appellate counsel wouldn't have that. So, you know, other upsides and downsides.
Well, it's like having an injured quarterback and you lost the previous game and let's put him in. Let's put him in. It's fine if he limps. Who cares?
Yeah, it's kind of like, let's put him in as the kicker. You know, like, let's put him in a different role. And I would never do it, but some attorneys might feel comfortable doing it.
Do you think this is a financial issue? Where, I mean, this is pure speculation, you know, of what and why she's keeping Jackie on here.
A finance issue. It varies by jurisdiction. It could be, but at least in Colorado, when you are convicted and sentenced to prison, if you don't have finances, you would be appointed a public defender who would take a look at the possibility of appeal and would assert that for you if appropriate. So I imagine that principle is present in Florida, where this case went down. And even if she didn't have money, she'd probably be appointed an attorney to look at the appeal. So I'm not sure it's finances.
If you have the option And you're sitting there going, Tom Petty lookalike, appointed attorney from the state. Which one do you pick? Which one do you pick?
Yeah, I'm going appointed attorney all the way because they're appellate specialists. Filing an appellate brief is hard as heck. Oftentimes, there's all these rules and procedural requirements, and to have trial, like, I'm good, you know, in front of a jury, but my skill set is not, you know, compiling 40 cases that support my appeal and doing that. It's usually a division of labor that is divided between two attorneys, not one.
You think Donna's aware that she has this right, or do you think it's something where it's like her and Jack? I gotcha. You don't want those state people. We're good here. We're like, you want to use me. I wonder what the conversation is. Donna's still sticking there with it because I could see her sticking with her because I feel like there is some camaraderie there. And I know that everyone is wrong there. And her seeing everybody looking at Jackie and going, They misunderstood you too. And oh my goodness. See, we were just trying to, they'll get it next time. I wonder if that's what's going on here.
Would not be surprised. You know, Jennifer commented that Donna still wants the crematorium discount. And so maybe that's factoring.
I wonder if that's part of it. Like, you got to use us till death. That's part of the contract. And then. Yeah.
I mean, you develop a rapport with your attorney. You go through this crucible, and it is dramatic for everybody. And so perhaps Donna just feels that rapport and that closeness with the attorney, and that can influence clients' decisions in terms of counsel.
Let's talk about Wendy Adelson a little bit. Obviously, nothing has happened. She's innocent till proven guilty. Not even that. She's never been charged with anything. So, but we're going to talk about her because there's a lot of questions. Is she next? We've seen the Adelsons get knocked over like dominoes for the last several years. And, well, I mean, her or Harvey seem like the next logical people if they had anything to do with this. And that is a big if. Georgia Kappelman making the comment the other day, when pressed, and I want to say that because there's a lot of people talking, oh, she's came out and said, stay tuned. No, she was pressed. An attorney, a reporter literally put the words in her mouth and said, would you stay tuned? I would say stay tuned. That's kind of how that conversation went. What do you think on that? What's your take on George's response there?
Yeah, so I think the DA has to keep things open in terms of any possible culpable parties. You know, I'm not accusing Wendy of anything. She hasn't been charged.
Sure.
But it certainly strikes me as odd that, like, her entire family would orchestrate this murder-for-hire plot on which they've two members have been convicted and all the other helpers have been convicted. And Wendy, who's really at the center of this, was the one married to the victim. She had nothing to do with it and had no knowledge about it and didn't want it to happen. You know, think about that as a partner. Your entire family just kills your ex-spouse because they don't like him without talking to you about it, without seeing if hey, is this okay? Those things strike me as odd.
I mean, it is extremely odd. It's not to say that it couldn't happen, but I guess even odder would be, how do you not look guilty if your family did this and you had nothing to do with it? I think it'd be very hard because everybody is staring at you and the optics of every single move that you make. And they already had the preconceived notion because you're the one who benefited from this, that you had something to do with this, even if you didn't. I don't know how you enter the or live in the public sphere in any way, shape, or form. And I'm just saying, just living your life without everybody looking at you going, yeah, we think you might've had something to do with it, no matter how you act.
Yeah, Tony, that's a really important point because let's look at it from that perspective. Let's say Wendy had nothing to do with this. And so what has happened is her family has taken these nefarious actions to kill the father of her children, with whom she wasn't getting along, clearly, but may not have wished to death upon him, probably didn't wish for her children to not have a father for the rest of their lives. Her life has been turned upside down for the past decade. She has been in the public eye in a negative way for a decade. If she didn't do if she had no involvement in this, how terrible would that be for her? That'd be a nightmare.
Yeah, it very much, very much would be. I think one of the most powerful pieces of testimony that we saw in Donna's case actually came from her ex-boyfriend, Jeff Lacases, saying that Wendy told him her family had looked into all options, even mentioning hiring a hitman and estimating costs. He saw this as more than a joke, describing it as her tone as being serious, because she pulled him aside and said, hey, can I tell you something kind of in confidence here? This is what was discussed. So then we get back to, okay, if your family is literally telling you, we've looked into all options, Charlie didn't say, I hired a hitman. He said, I looked into all options, according to Wendy. What sort of responsibility do you have as a human being, as a functioning member of society, when someone tells you, we've looked into a hitman to kill your ex-husband? Do you stay silent? Do you turn that person in? Does anything happen if you turn that person in? Or, you know, it's just talk at that moment in time anyway.
You know, gosh, there's certainly a distinction between a legal duty and a moral duty. You know, in terms of a moral duty, I would think that a person would want to and feel compelled morally to take measures to prevent some unjustified and unlawful killing of someone, especially someone they know. On the legal side, receiving that information in and of itself probably does not trigger a legal duty to report it. There's no like Good Samaritan law that provides an affirmative obligation on somebody possessing that knowledge to run to the cops and say, hey, I think there could be, or it's possible that there could be a murder for hire coming up. Could you guys stop this? I don't think there's a legal duty to do that.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.